Hey, check us out. Three motherfuckers. All right, everybody. Welcome to the Basin Triple Podcast. My name is Neil.
And I'm Steve. And this week we have a special guest with us. Everyone say hi to Doug.
Oh, hey, Doug.
Hey, everybody. What's going on?
Nothing much. Just glad to have another person along for this crazy ride.
I really appreciate the invite.
This week we're going to talk about a classic album that Doug picked, Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon.
And then later on, we're going to talk about the Sucky Song of the Week, brought to you by the wonderful country of Sweden. And surprisingly, it's not ABBA.
I wish I knew how to say one thing in Swedish right now. All I could think of is candy.
All I could think is IKEA furniture.
Oh, that's right. I thought they were Norwegian.
Those meatballs, dude.
Oh yeah. Cheap and good. So yeah, this album, I don't think anybody's ever heard of it. It's a real, like, out there, kind of like, I don't know if anybody's going to really relate to the, I'm just kidding. So this week's album, Dark Side of the Moon, was picked by Doug. It's by Pink Floyd, which is comprised of David Gilmour, Roger Waters, Richard Wright, and Nick Mason at the time of the recording. Came out March 1st, 1973. So Doug, you picked this album because you are our most special guest of the week, and we, want to know why you picked this album. What does this album mean to you?
Basically, it reminds me of a time when I was invincible, 18 years old, whole life ahead of me, and just, you know, driving in Central Florida with the windows down listening to this album. You know, this album grips you, even though it was, you know, 20 years after its time. It just, a love affair again for me when I heard this album.
You've never been the same.
Nice.
Yeah, dude.
Yeah. This album's got a lot of deep meanings, which for your 15-year-old self was probably life-changing, I would say. Talks about conflict, talks about greed, and I think kind of the quintessential Pink Floyd album.
Yeah, Neil, when did you get turned on to this album? I think there was a moment in everyone's life where Pink Floyd just hit them across the face and you've never been the same.
I got turned on to this album when I got a tabletop record player and I bought the whatever 80-pound vinyl special edition 30th anniversary or whatever the hell it was. That's I remember. Actually, 30th anniversary edition. I got the special vinyl. I've heard songs and bits and pieces, but the first time I heard this whole album was on vinyl in 2003. So I was, I don't know. I wasn't that old, but I would have been a junior in high school. The first time I heard this album, I got into some of the other classic Pink Floyd albums first. Probably Wish You Were Here was the first, and then The Wall second, and then listen to Dark Side. And later on, we'll talk about the whole Wizard of Oz, Dark Side of the Moon thingamabob, which I did. Definitely, we made one of those when I was a kid.
Yeah, that's what college was all about.
Definitely.
So what do you guys think? Like, what's the better album, The Wall or Dark Side?
That's an excellent question.
I'm allowed to ask that, right?
Not for me. Not for me, it is it. It's an excellent question, but it's the easiest one to answer because The Wall is just like Roger Waters' like brain goo. And I think Dark Side is just much better. It's a much better album.
Dark Side is more artistic, but The Wall actually is like a little rock opera. It tells an entire story. It's got like scenes and acts. And
it was a movie.
It's like comparing a song against a symphony.
Whoa.
Yeah, I mean, I guess.
That was deep.
I don't know. There's a lot of... I think this is just... Dark Side was like the prelude to The Wall, and The Wall just went into one subject really deeply. I mean, they're great. They're both great albums. I just... For me, it's an easy decision. But then again, my favorite Pink Floyd album is Animals, so I'm kind of weird. Yeah, so Steve, why don't you go over the themes a little more, and then we could talk about all the stuff this album has done, because it's one about everything, right?
It's a very accomplished album. But yeah, I mean, by listening to this, it really took me a long time before I realized what this album was even about. Like, it's so musical, you get sucked into the music, and you kind of hear the words, and you can kind of grasp it, but you kind of have to look at the entire album overall to get a feel for the major themes and what they were really shooting for.
I think it's one of the few albums that truly does that, you know, like the way it's a story from beginning to end. I think I heard a story one time. I don't know if it's true, so this might be made up, that they didn't want to go
on
iTunes.
We fact check everything on here, Doug. So if it's not true, we'll have to like deduct 5 cents from your pay.
Doug was murdered shortly after this episode. No, I heard they didn't want to go on iTunes because they didn't want people to buy the songs individually. They didn't want to carve pieces of the pie out. You know, it was a journey. This album's a journey.
Yeah.
That actually makes a lot of sense. The album's a journey in a lot of ways. The entire thing is just one long track. The songs bleed into each other. And even if you were to play it start to finish and loop it back around, it loops back into itself. It starts out with the heartbeat. It ends up with a heartbeat. If you play it on repeat, it's just one long track.
Steve, I think what you're trying to say is that it's definitely one of those "let's roll another one, bro" type albums. It's just going and going and going. You know, other than just general conflict and talking about greed and everything, it talks about getting older, getting tired. I think this album, what they were trying to do with this album, specifically like Roger Waters and the whole band, this is more of a David Gilmour and Richard Wright album than a Roger Waters album, I'd say, as far as like content and writing. But I think it was one of those albums where they were actually trying to change the world. Like, a lot of the messages in here are really deep and talk about, you know, human emotion and how to be generally a better person. And they did it in like a non-direct kind of way, you know, still being psychedelic about it. And it also talks about mental illness, which is a kickback to Syd Barrett's deteriorating mental state. He was one of the founding members of the band and was soon replaced by David Gilmour. Roger Waters kind of learned how to sing, and they may do without him.
Yeah, these are big themes that this album discusses. It's like big, you know, global, worldly stuff that everyone can relate to kind of stuff. They're universal themes.
Yeah.
You know, especially as this band was growing and getting big and making a name for themselves, they came across a lot of money, and this album, of course, just helped it. But they think about greed and how you take care of yourself and time and money and great gig in the sky. Everything that they touch on is something that relates to every single human being, which could be why it sold so many copies, won so many awards, and goes down as one of the best albums ever, is because it's a universal feeling in a way.
Yeah, and yeah, that's a great point.
Even the theme on mental illness, it's, you know, hopefully not all of us will go as crazy as Syd Barrett, but we all, I think, as humans, it's human nature to kind of, you know, deal with that demon inside and try to balance yourself against social norms, and that's really what a lot of the themes are about. They're human, they're universal.
Yeah, I think as you get older, you think about things like that, you know, like mental illness, I mean, passage of time. These are things you think about more as you grow older, as you live life, I believe. I don't know.
Yeah, and regarding the topic of mental illness specifically, you know, the song Brain Damage, I think, is the most obvious choice. But I think later on the band, Wish You Were Here, spend definitely more time, tracks like Shine On You Crazy Diamond, kind of going over his whole mental demise. And I think the best way to prevent that from happening is to just not do a lot of acid. Because that's...
No, I don't like that answer. That won't work.
I think he was doing it to be more and more creative. I think that he was one of those, like, I need this to be creative type of artist types. And he continued to do paintings and things of the sort. And he was obviously filthy rich because he was a member of Pink Floyd, but...
See, the problem is LSD won't kill you. He is a victim of the 60s drug culture as much as the 90s artists were victims of the heroin culture.
Real quick, without Googling it, what year do you think Syd Barrett died?
1994?
2007.
That's very recent.
Yeah. So he lived a pretty long life of being fucked up on drugs.
Is it better to burn out or fade away?
It's better to fade away at all. Cool. So, Steve, why don't you go over the accolades of this awesome album real quick?
Because it's a really long list. I don't even know where to start. Well, we can start with this album sold 50 million copies. That's, what is that, like 5 times platinum or something?
Isn't there one for, like, isn't there a diamond or something above platinum?
Yeah, 10 million. 10 million is diamond, so it's actually 5 times diamond. But, you know, those all awards are, like, certified by the, like, some institution. At 50 million number, Steve, what I checked, that's a worldwide sale number, which is
okay.
Ridiculous.
That's so right. It's 15 albums. Million in the U.S. alone, 4 million in the U.K., it's 1 million in Germany, 2.5 in France. It's all over the place. You add that up, and it gets real high real quick. So it's 15 times platinum in the U.S. alone. Yeah.
The French love Pink Floyd.
There's no one that doesn't love Pink Floyd, man. Like I said, it's universal. Doesn't matter what continent you're on.
No, I've met people that don't like Pink Floyd. Like, I've met those people, and I quickly unmeet them and try to move on with my life.
I actually gauge someone's, like, music maturity on if they know Pink Floyd. That's my first, like, let's feel the waters question. Then usually I go STP.
that's a hell of a jump. Like,
Pink Floyd. Well, you know, STP is like more narrowed in. Not everyone knows STP. If you don't know Pink Floyd, then the only thing I can back out of that is like the Beatles.
That's the universal connector.
And then I wonder if you have even heard music.
Oh, there's a good friend of mine who does not like the Beatles, who is like just not a Beatles fan.
That's fair.
And he's still a good friend of yours.
So, in the U.S., only Michael Jackson's Thriller and Led Zeppelin 4 have sold more albums than Dark Side of the Moon.
So we have Michael Jackson and two British bands in the top three spots in the U.S.?
That's right. And Michael Jackson's not American. He's from another planet.
I thought AC/DC was on the list, too. Back in Black!
Back in Black! Back in Black! Let it loose! Let it loose! Yeah, that song is terrible.
My name's Angus!
Like the beef. Yeah. So, in 2013, you were saying, Steve, they were selected for a preservation in the United States National Recording Registry by the Library of Congress for being deemed culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. Well, that's kind of vague. So they were one of those three, or maybe all three, but I mean, they got preserved in the United States as being like a significant record in the country's history. That's pretty amazing to think that people usually equate Pink Floyd with just a kind of a stoner band, a Library of Congress, really.
There's so much more than that. Yeah. They recognize it for what it is.
What? So how did they debut on the Billboard's Top 200 album chart? Because there's a long history there, and I'll let you just kind of read off everything they've been doing there.
Well, yeah, this also comes in first when we're talking about the Billboard top charts. This is the longest running album on the charts ever by more than double the second place artist, which I think is a legend by Bob Marley. Right. He's been on the Billboard charts for half as long as this album.
Which doesn't really count either, because Legend is like a greatest hits compilation, right? It's not even like an album.
That you're absolutely right. Take all of Bob Marley's best stuff and put it together, and you still can't sell half as many albums as this album has sold. But it started its trek on the Billboard charts back in March of 1973. It came in at number 95. And it only made it to number one once for just 1 week. That's about it.
Yeah, well, that's kind of tough when Elton John, Elvis Presley, and Led Zeppelin put out albums that same
week. That's true. It was just a really, really good time for music.
Yeah, put me back there, man. It's crazy.
I know. Quaaludes. No condoms.
Black Bettys. Cheap room and board. French cigarettes. I'm sorry.
You're right. Let's go back to the 70s. It sounds all. You guys are making it sound amazing.
Never apologize for a good time.
But yeah, the week that it hit number one, Elvis and Led Zeppelin both had brand new records that week, and Pink Floyd made it to first. But I think the most amazing thing is that it's been on the Billboard charts for 15 years. That's a lifetime to a lot of people. Anyone who's 15 years or younger.
It's just amazing. That's a long time.
Yeah. It continues to sell more than any other record every single week for 15 years. Until 1988, after 736 weeks, it finally fell out. Came back for a little while, and then it fell off again.
Dude, 15 years. I heard that every cell in the body changes every 7 years. So you're like, you're a completely new person every 7 years. That's two lifetimes if that whatever I just said makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
Two deaths.
This album was selling more than any others. Made it into the charts for 15 years straight. It didn't even drop off the charts once in 15 years. That's kind of ridiculous.
While we're on the subject of cellular reproduction, is that different when you're really fat? Like, if you're 500 pounds, does it also take you 7 years? Or does it take you a little longer? I'm wondering if the body just kind of keeps up, you know? That's a good question. It's a question for a different podcast, a scientific podcast.
We'll talk about that in our biology podcast, falling right behind this one. Biology talk with complete idiots. I don't know, something about chlorophyll? I don't know.
More like borophyll.
Oh, wow. Yeah, so we're going to go through the tracks, which is our new theme of doing things on this podcast, because we get to talk really in depth about the album. Doug, why don't you kick this off? So the first track is "Speak to Me, Breathe." I think we're all gonna really like all these songs, but let's just talk a little bit about what we like about each of these songs. So the first song, "Speak to Me, Breathe," is actually two tracks that were melded into one. "Speak to Me" was a Richard Wright compilation, and then "Breathe" was a Waters, Gilmore, and Wright compilation. As far as writing credits, what are your thoughts on that track? What did you like about it?
I like the heartbeat.
Coming in?
Yeah, I like that it starts out very slow. Yeah, no, there's no music to it. There's nothing. It's like the heartbeat kind of brings you to life. It brings you into the album.
Right.
It's a good way to start it out. It kind of slowly gets you introduced into the album. It's not like it hits you all at once and get ready for a wild ride. It's like, let me start out slow and subtle, and at first you won't even hear it. And then that opening chord hits, and all of a sudden you know you're in for a ride.
Oh yeah, when it's so smooth. I love that part.
Yeah, that's one of the coolest guitar chords like ever, and just the changes. Also, I didn't think about this when I was putting together my notes for this podcast, but that guitar sound, that super twangy guitar, that's a pedal steel guitar. And I would challenge to say that pedal steel guitar and psychedelic rock had it really made friends if it wasn't for Pink Floyd. Like, that's a really cool instrument, but rarely used in rock. It's more of like a country instrument. I'm going to probably say a little too much in this podcast, but David Gilmour, Roger Waters, this is their first time that they like fought in the studio. They had a different idea for this album. And the first thing David Gilmour said was, "Sing less, Roger. I want to sing more." And a lot of these songs, like on this song, that's David Gilmour singing. He's singing all of the vocal parts in this song. It's kind of amazing when you think about Roger Waters is the singer for the band, technically. David kind of did his thing.
Could you imagine how this album, how this album would have worked out if he had his way and was able to do it his style? Do you think it would have been as successful?
Probably not, because I think David Gilmour's voice is just a little more like deadpan. Roger Waters has a very like strong and distinct tone. David Gilmour's more kind of smooth. I think it really fits the album well that he did a lot more vocals. So I think it's a great intro to a song. It's one of these songs that when I first learned how to play guitar, I was like freaking out. Like, oh my God, speak to me.
This sounds like it's supposed to. So we follow up that track with On the Run.
What are these early electronic music songs, man? Crazy loop synth. It's way ahead of its time. Way ahead of its time as far as putting that in a popular music sense.
You're right. If this came out in 1973, you know, using synthesizers and stuff for music, anything that plugs into a wall, anything with electricity running through it to make music is not quite there yet.
Yeah.
So, you're right. The sound that came out of this track is pretty amazing.
And it had, like, airplanes in the background and stuff, you know, which was kind of neat. I think it actually ends with, like, an airplane crash. The machine they used to make this in the song, to do that, the machine is so cool, man. Like, I saw a video about it. It's like a little drum pad, and you literally hit the four notes that you want in the loop. And then you have all these controls where you could speed it up and slow it down and change what note is the main note. It was like, just, and it's all analog. So back then, there's all this stuff weighed like 800 pounds, which I think is really cool.
And it can make a once-in-a-lifetime unique sound.
Hell yeah. And so track three is Time, which is kind of like the first two really set you up, I think. And then Time starts off with all the cuckoo clocks, right?
Yep, it kind of grabs your attention. All of a sudden, like, guess what? It's time to really get down to business here. We're going to talk about the real big themes of the album. It's more than just, you know, some good ambient music. But here's some clocks in your face. Time to wake up. Coincidentally, Time is the longest track on the album. It comes in at almost 7 minutes straight.
Right, and we didn't put it on the track listing, but that the end of Time is like the reprise of the song Breathe, where it's the second part of Breathe. So when time kicks off, I want to note that like those notes in the beginning of Time, like the ba 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 ba, all those cool notes in the beginning, totally remind me of The Wall, the way that The Wall starts off with those like heavy notes.
Right. Big resounding noises.
Yeah, super like get your attention.
Oh, that's what they're famous for, pulling you in, gripping your soul.
Hell yeah.
That's what Pink Floyd does.
And not that we're keeping track, but this is definitely like my second favorite track on the album. I love this song.
Well, I think a big part of that might have to do with the lyrics. Like, you know, if the first two were kind of warm-up tracks and then this comes in, this is where they start telling their story. This is where they start, you know, reaching out with their themes and grabbing you and getting the point of the album across. Time is one of the big themes here.
The lyrics even talk about religion. The lyrics even talk about religion at the end, talking about call it the tolling of the Iron Bell. Again, tolling of the Iron Bell, division right. Bell. Tolling of the Iron Bell brings the faithful to their knees to sing the softly spoken magic spells. Like, that's...
Softly spoken magic spells. Dude, even the, like, the track listing, I mean, that's telling a story right there. Speak to me, breathe, on the run, time. That's someone growing increasingly crazy, you know, starting to lose a little bit, thinking about how is time passing? It's what's happening to me, you know?
Yeah. I think you could take this album and kind of split it into, like, it's almost like one half and second half, because it goes right into the Great Gig in the Sky, track four. The Great Gig in the Sky sounds like, to me, it sounds like dying, right? It sounds like death. Like, now you've gone through time, and here's dying, and the song is Claire Torrey, who's a singer, doing female vocals. I mean, it's a combination of piano and screaming, but it's like, it's just... really kind of out there.
It really is. It's frequently regarded as one of Richard Wright's greatest achievements.
Yeah, and it gets super soft, like in the middle, and it goes up again, and then it ends really soft, and all of the singing was ad-lib. Like, none of it was planned. They just
really? Went
to the studio, and yeah, David Gilmour just like worked with her, and they did it in like four takes. It was like, she was like, okay.
You know, I kind of think that this song is like the ice cream in an ice cream sandwich.
Whoa.
Mm-hmm.
It starts out with Time, and which is a very lyrical track, and then it goes into this instrumental Great Gig in the Sky for 4.5 minutes, and then it comes back with Money, which is another song just like Time. It's over 6 minutes long. It's very lyrical. It tells a story, but the Great Gig in the Sky just kind of fits right in between, and it's creamy like an ice cream sandwich.
I was thinking Money, Cream, Money Shot, so that's where my mind went.
What?
We was talking about the cream on the ice cream sandwich is the gig in the sky, right? The cream's on the outside of the sandwich, right? As it melts. But, so next you have like your money
cream
shot.
Cream pie, money shot, cream pie. So let's not just run away from the track Money or let's skip it, because it is the coup d'etat of this album. It's a 7/4 loop of sounds that Roger Waters, the demo, he made it like in his greenhouse with just random shit, coin full of jars, of old cash register, turn it into a 7/4 loop, which is crazy. It's in 7/4 and it's the hit song. That's
yeah.
Fun.
Well, we were just talking about the Gorillaz track last week of 5/4 and right. How syncopated rhythm is kind of cool. It's kind of rare to pull off a hit song with an odd time signature like that. But there's something about this beat that made it the most popular song on the album.
You gotta give it so much credit, because it's 7/4 and then it goes into a 4/4 section with a guitar solo. But first it starts off with a saxophone solo. Like, you hear saxophone solo, you think of Careless Whispers. But no, this is a rock sax solo, which is really, really super impressive.
In 7/4.
And the lyrics are awesome. Yeah, you're right, Doug. The sax solo is in 7/4, and then the guitar solo comes in 4/4, which is even, how the hell did they time that? I have no idea. I used to be in a cover band that tried to pull this song off, and I've given my drummer so many dirty looks while we're playing this. Like, why can't you keep time? Looking at me like... 7/4. So yeah, it's real rough,
but fun to listen to.
Yeah, no, an amazing song. All kinds of connections to the Wall movie, right? Isn't this the lyrics that the schoolmaster reads when young Pink is at his desk?
You're right. Good right? call. Yeah,
really?
That's a subtle little hint there.
Like, new car, caviar, four stars, a dream. Think I'd buy me a football team. Nonsense, laddie. get back to your work.
Wow. Nice catch. Catch.
You sound like you're from London.
So the just to finish on Money, did you know that the guitar solo for Money was done on a 24-fret guitar? Full double octave guitar. That's insane. That's why he hits all those super, super, super duper high notes. And this song pretty much put him in, like, guitar god area, especially coming out with Led Zeppelin at the same time. This solo was off the chain.
From Money?
Yeah, dude. The guitar solo in Money is awesome. It has like three sections. It gets super quiet, and it gets super loud again. It's intense. It's one of those Guitar Hero songs that anybody who loves guitar playing will say David Gilmour's a god, and it's this song. This song and Comfortably Numb are like the two most common songs that you connect with him in guitar playing, I think.
I feel like this song is like, yeah, acclaimed or whatever as number one on the album.
Yep, I think you're right, Doug.
This is the song that I heard first on this entire album. When we got our first CD player when I was a little kid, my dad put on this album, put headphones on, and said, you gotta check this out, because the way that the Money sounds go back and forth from ear to ear was super cool at the time. And especially listening to that high-def CD audio, that was like, alright, let me school you a little bit on music. You gotta know about Money.
Yeah, back then they used to mess with you with those recordings. And I remember in this that it would go like left, right, left, right, but then it would go like left, left, like it would mess with your head because you're saying like, oh, it's gonna go on this ear. No, it's not. It's on this ear now. Yeah.
Leave it up to Pink Floyd to mess with your head.
Right. So the next song, Us and Them, that's a really kind of like a softer, beautiful song.
Yeah, the album really takes a turn here, I think.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, it's got some awesome lyrics. It's got kind of a Orwellian type theme to it, talking about, you know, people dying for no reason and separation of society. And it's,
wow, that's deep, dude.
It's true. You think about it, after all, we're only ordinary men. For part of the price of tea and spice, the old man dies. So the next track, we're getting close towards the end here. Track 7, Any Color You Like, Color the British Way with a U.
Yeah, they have their flavors and their colors and their honors. They throw extra U's in there for no good reason at all.
Not that it matters to anybody except for me. It's my favorite song on this album. Mostly because the sounds you hear are due to a little thing called the Leslie Rotary Speaker.
Tell us about the Leslie Rotary Speaker.
Hell yeah, I will. A typical Leslie speaker contains an amplifier and a treble and a bass loudspeaker combination that projects a signal from an electric instrument, in this case a guitar or a keyboard, while modifying the sound by rotating the loudspeakers on a slower, fast setting. So they put a mic in front of it, and then these loudspeakers go do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. And so what you hear is what's called tremolo, that natural tremolo sound. Tro-lo-lo-lo-lo. And it's just amazing. Like in this song, they use it perfectly, and the guitar playing is like at the perfect speed for the actual effect. And it just, every time I hear it, it turns me on. And I also like the way it kind of weaves into Brain Damage at the end. It's like, like it's the only time I think I've ever heard a song play a guitar solo that leads into another song on an album. It's like not usually.
See? Thing. The reason why I can never remember what this song sounds like, because to me, it's just the end of Us and Them. It almost feels like these two tracks should be the same. You're right. At this point, towards the end of the album, all the tracks bleed into another. From one into the next to the next, there's really no cutoff where one begins and the other one ends.
But Any Color You Like is funky. It's more of a... It's like the funkiest song on the album. Out of all of the songs in this album, including Money, it's the most out of place. Like, it just doesn't make any... Like, it's departure from what they were just doing by doing this instrumental jam song.
I think that's, like, I think that's the point, you know? Like, you're starting to experience brain damage now, you know? Like, your brain pattern waves are kind of going crazy, you know? Sine, cosine, whatnot. Like, it's getting funky.
I never thought of it that way. Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it.
Do you think it would be a better song if it was placed somewhere else in the album? Because The Great Gig in the Sky is also an instrumental, but it's in between Time and Money, which I think is perfect placement. This is also an instrumental, but do you think it just doesn't fit as well because of its placement between the tracks?
I think it fits perfectly. I just think it's like Us and Them is really slow, and then all of a sudden it goes into Any Color You Like, that it just turns, it's the same way that The Great Gig in the Sky gives Time and Money, which have a lot of words and a lot of thinking, it gives it space for you to reflect. You just listen to Us and Them, which is kind of all the tracks on this album, I'd say I hate to say my least favorite, but it kind of is my least favorite because it's just slow and it's kind of like depressing. And it just kind of gives you a great lead into Brain Damage, which is just like, whoa, you know?
Brain Damage is enough to give you brain damage. This is the song that, yeah, hits on the themes of Syd Barrett, kind of losing your mind.
And I would challenge to say that most kids at the age of 14 or 15 who think about playing guitar, they learn this song. It's like really simple, and it's got really cool lyrics about lobotomies and being in a nut house. So Doug, you want to talk a little bit about Brain Damage? Do you like that song? Does it fit your life story well?
Yeah, I'm kind of a funky natured guy, and you know, this song that kind of rounds the album out. I do dig it, you know. And what can I say? This whole album is soul gripping, you know, amazing.
My theory on Brain Damage is that the track and the lyrics are not only they're a throwback to Syd Barrett, who kind of lost his mind. I think it's kind of saying like, now that you know the truth, you're going a little crazy, because they already talked about like, you know, how you're always moving and how time is precious and how you're gonna die and how you make money a priority and how you're separating society and going to war for no reason. Now you're just going crazy. Now like track A, it's like, you're crazy. All this information is now making you cuckoo.
Information overload, it's a common theme in today's age. Here they were talking about it years and years ago.
Exactly. It's like all of this good, informative information, it's like you can't handle it now. It gets to some cool lyrics, and I think one of the neat things about this album is that you can take it super seriously, but it's at the end of the day, it's got enough room to breathe and enough lyrics that are kind of disjointed and all over the place that anybody, it paints with a broad brush, I guess is what I could say. That's why I think it's so universally popular.
The lunatic is in my head. And then it wraps up with Eclipse,
which I know Steve is like a really, really one of your favorite tracks because of the lyrics that go on in there about all that you touch and all you, what is it?
All you touch and all you see is all your life will ever be.
That's actually from, that's not from that song at all. That's from the first song, from Breathe.
That's right.
I guess you know why I equated that? Because a long time ago, I tried to show you a video, Steve, and I was like, oh, dude, this is like it's something really messed up. And I remember you being like, nah, dude, I'm not going to watch that because, you know, all you touch and all you see is all your life will ever be. And I'm like, this mother right here, he's like, damn, quoting Floyd with his life philosophy and shit.
Well, it's absolutely true. Look at the internet these days. You have your choice between anything on the planet. If it happened anywhere, you have the option to watch it. You have the option to read about the Kardashians, or you can, you know, choose to fill your world with stuff that's beautiful and meaningful to you. And if all you touch and all you see is all your life will ever be, then it's up to you to make the choice of what you want to expose yourself to.
I love the way you put that, dude. And not to get all transcendental on you guys, but like, yeah, I agree. People absorb more than they realize, you know? You gotta surround yourself with beauty and good things and good people like you motherfuckers to get the best out of life.
And I think you're absolutely right, Doug. Totally. And you can never get too transcendental with us. And one quick thing I want to say, Transcendental sounds like a great company for a mobile dental service.
Transcendental.
Dude, that's $1 million idea. That has to make money for us. Can't offer you all your eggs in one basket, dude. I'm serious.
That's exactly what I want. I want someone drilling my teeth as we're going down the highway at 60 miles an hour.
Yeah.
It's an awesome idea.
Hang on a second. Bro, I wish kind of packed. Okay, you're all done. You can get out. You can get out. You're good. Just don't eat for a few hours. Thanks, guys. So, Steve, why don't you talk about the hit tracks in the album?
Well, it's hard to really say because it wasn't a very radio-friendly commercial hit album. It really made a lot of its sales based on the fact that it's a full album in itself. Now, there's Money and there's Time, which I guess were the two, you know, most popular tracks. I don't know if they made videos for either one of these, but it seems like the songs or the lyrics made them radio-friendly enough where they were considered the hits on the album.
I have a question. Do you think radio sucked back then the way it does now? Like, is it as commercially driven and you hear the same pop top 40 like over and over?
In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. There's always heavy rotation. There's always the songs that are hot in the moment, and they're going to play them until you're sick of them. But I think there was at least a bit more variety in what was in heavy rotation.
Kind of the thing that I know was true back then is that they wanted you to make shortened versions of your songs that were 3 minutes or less, because that's what radio stations were demanding, were 3 minute or less tracks. So I think the reason these two tracks were the only radio-friendly ones was for two reasons. Number one, they did come out with single or radio edit versions of them, because I've heard them where they're shortened.
Really?
Like the Money version of it completely cuts out the sax solo. Yeah, completely cuts out the sax solo, so you get it under, I think, 3:30. And then Time, they completely shortened the intro by like half. But of the two of the on the album, they're the only two songs that have a beginning and end, you could say, where like they don't like bleed into something else. So
right,
much.
They're distinct tracks.
Right. But yeah, those are the two hits. And I think as singles, they sold a ton, but they didn't really need to do too much work as singles because the album was doing so well.
Yep.
Wait, I want to touch on this for 1 second. It's something that was instrumental for me growing up. We did this. We took my friend Hunter's CD player and we took his VHS and we synced Dark Side of the Moon with The Wizard of Oz. Watched it like idiots.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Made sense of it like it fit when... I like literally, you could take any album. You could take like a Coheed and Cambria album and sync it up to Made in Manhattan and it'll probably sync up. Like at some
I'd
point.
Like to try that. I think I have a new a new hobby.
But just real quick, because there's too many stories where I don't even remember what happened back when we were doing that. The best quote on the subject of that sync, it came directly from the drummer Pink Floyd, Dick Mason, when he told MTV in 1997, "It's absolute nonsense. It has nothing to do with The Wizard of Oz. It's all based on The Sound of Music."
Yeah.
Which I think is awesome.
Has anyone synced up The Sound of Music? Could you imagine what they're singing about?
No, but you could take Wish You Were Here, and it syncs up perfectly to Blade Runner.
I heard you can watch both of those on YouTube, yeah.
I'm not even...
They haven't pre-synced up for you, so yeah. You can't even mess it up. Because I think it's supposed to be like the third Lion Roar, yeah. You start the album or something.
Yeah, like it, you know, it's all in the sky, and it's airplane sounds.
I heard that if you play Have a Cigar, and you mix that up with the third episode of My Little Pony, it goes together so well. It was like meant to be together. I think they did it on purpose. I might have just made that one up.
Yeah, that time when Glitter stars in the show, when she first gets her wings, that's when the guitar solo starts.
What's the phenomenon? Is this a recent thing? Because my nephew, who's 18, I think 18 or 19 now, it was like a phenomenon for his generation of like kids, like boys, knowing My Little Pony and like watching My Little Pony. Like if they had older sisters.
Or younger sisters.
They totally got into My Little Pony. Yeah. Which I just find like, I mean, it's cool, and I think you only grow by watching My Little Pony. You don't recede.
It helps you mature as a person, but, as a 3-year-old.
We should move on because this is going absolutely nowhere.
All right, so guys, tell me if you can make any comparisons to Dark Side of the Moon or Pink Floyd in general. What would you come up with? Name another album that's like Dark Side of the Moon.
Oh, Sgt. Pepper's a great example of an album similar to Dark Side of the Moon. The way that kind of like it has an ongoing theme. I like to say it is, but it kind of isn't at the same time because it's a little more upbeat, I guess. I personally think, and I'll just leave it at this, I personally think that the three albums before this album for Pink Floyd were all just loose versions of Dark Side of the Moon. So like Uma Guma, Adam Hartmother, and Metal all have pieces and building blocks that you could see led to Dark Side of the Moon.
They were all psychedelic albums. All three of the ones that you mentioned there are, I think they're after Syd Barrett's time, is that right?
Uma Guma wasn't. Okay. He was still around for Uma Guma.
Adam Hartmother and Metal were both psychedelic. Half of Metal is just one track, the whole side B.
Yeah, but Echoes, think of Echoes for a second. Echoes sounds like it could have been on Dark Side of the Moon.
Mm.
Like it's just,
yeah, I think
it,
you're right.
It sounds like very similar, right? Vocally, totally mellowed out. But yeah, definitely more psychedelic. I can't think of a Pink Floyd, of a Dark Side of the Moon equivalent. I'm drawing a blank.
Can I throw OK Computer out there?
Sure may.
This is kind of like the 90s version of Dark Side of the Moon in the way that it was super ambient. And even when you talk about some of the themes in the album, they're talking about loss. They're talking about trying to function in the modern world. It shares a lot of the themes, but it, I guess in a more 90s style. Maybe I can throw the coincidence out there that Radiohead is also a British band.
Yep, that's coincidental. So yeah, I don't think there's something directly like it, but Steve, OK Computer is a really good equivalent of a 90s version of Dark Side of the Moon.
I'm trying to think of any other examples of albums that play all the way through, where the tracks bleed into each other and it sounds like one long session.
Blood Sugar Sex Magik.
Nice.
Honestly, like if I listen to a song from Blood Sugar Sex Magik and it's not followed up by the next song in the album, I'm thoroughly disappointed.
I see what you're saying. So the tracks have to be in order, but it's not quite the same as one track bleeding into another, is it?
No, I mean Zep did that with Led Zeppelin 3 was really kind of like all the way through, but they sang more about like chicks and putting their dicks in chicks. It's a little different. I think when you try to compare it, it can't just be like track listing. It has to be like, man, you know, deep thoughts. Like, honestly, I could probably put, you could probably take Yes's album Fragile is an equivalent.
Yes.
That's, Yes was inspired a lot by Pink Floyd. I mean, they were only a couple of years after Pink Floyd, Dark Side
yes.
of the Moon. But they're ultimately progressive. Like, they're more progressive and more complex. But their album Fragile was like that. Like it was a song about longing and belonging and love. And it's a little more hippie. But I think when people think of Pink Floyd, maybe not people, but when like the musician in me thinks of Pink Floyd, I think of Yes. I think of like that really uber progressive musical side of like thinking. So yeah, let's do this week in music history. Are you guys satisfied with our overview of Dark Side of the Moon?
Yeah, no, I think we tore apart that album pretty well. We got a chance to touch on each of the themes, each of the tracks. It's a classic album and has won a lot of awards, and it's easy to see why.
Yeah, so this week in music history, back in 1966, John Lennon met Yoko Ono, for the first time when he visited her art exhibition, Unfinished Paintings and Objects at the Indica Gallery in London. Okay, Yoko, whatever you say.
Can you imagine what the world would be like if that had never happened?
I don't blame Yoko, man. I blame Paul for everything having to do with the Beatles. It's Paul's fault. And John, I trust.
John's a good man.
That's ridiculous.
So this week in 1967, Pink Floyd came to the U.S. for the first time. They had their first show in San Francisco, California. And this was 1967. This was the Summer of Love, or I guess the fall of the Summer of Love. But it was a huge concert. They shared the bill with a bunch of local bands, like Big Brother and La Holding Company, featuring Janis Joplin. And Richie Havens was on there, too.
Richie Havens is awesome. That's a hell of a person to share a stage with. He covers Tangled Up in Blue by Bob Dylan, and it's better than Bob Dylan's version. It's amazing. No, Richie Havens was like a really like kind of dirty Rastafarian looking black guy that played like weird tuned guitars with like single finger chords, and he's like, oh no, oh no. Yeah, yep, he was a dirty hippie, but awesome, awesome singer.
Okay, well, yeah, also in 1967, the first issue of Rolling Stone magazine was published in San Fran. It was just featured the guy you were talking about, John Lennon, on the cover, dressed in army fatigues while acting in his recent film, Howie Won the War. and the first issue had a free roach clip to hold a marijuana joint. Wow. Yeah, you were talking about earlier, we were alive during the wrong time. Yeah. Agree.
Yeah, that's a hell of a gift to get with your new subscription.
Although it's Rolling Stone magazine, not much has changed. I think every single episode, every single issue they release has some sort of article about the war on drugs or about marijuana industry. Seems like they've stayed true to their roots.
Or the latest Bruce Springsteen sighting, or the latest Bob Dylan album no one's going to buy. They keep some things consistent. But anyways, in 1975, a new world record was set for continuous guitar string plucking. Wow, talk about a time to be alive. By Steve Anderson, who played for 114 hours, 17 minutes.
Damn.
What the hell?
114 hours, what is that, like five days?
That's almost 5 days, like, and he probably died right after. Like, what, first of all, what was he playing? Like, was it just like an open guitar? Like, just no holding of, dude, I gotta find dude, that. There's gotta be a video of that
Neil,
somewhere.
You're a true musician. I like how your first question is, what did he play? Dude, the first question for me is, like, the logistics. With the bathroom, like, everything, like.
Oh, there was a bucket. He had to be wearing, like, a, what's it called? What is the Scottish kilt. People wear? I'm such an idiot. A kilt. Dude, he was probably burning so many calories that he didn't have to shit, because if you're strumming a guitar for that long, or plucking. It specifically says plucking, Steve, so that's a...
A pluck is not the same as a strum?
Yeah, like, if there's a world record for strumming, it probably gets... Every time they're trying to set it, someone just probably comes up and punches the guy in the face. Like, you fucking prick. Boom. The hell's wrong with you?
You're right, dude. Around era 100, you know, plucking gets pretty arduous.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Those last 14 hours, ruling. 17 minutes, that's where it's at. So, a record never to be broken again, because nobody gives a shit.
So, this week also, 1993, my world changed when Dave Matthews Band came on the scene. They released their first album this week in 1993 called Remember Two Things. And this didn't take off so well. They really hit their stride with their next album.
Real quick, could I ask you a question? Did they always have that many people in the Dave Matthews Band, like, just starting off?
Yeah, they started out with, five.
Add more.
Five artists in the band.
Oh, okay.
And now I think they're up to...
And now they're up to, like, 18?
20, somewhere around there.
Yeah, there's a lot of dudes. That's a lot of room and board.
They also play with, you know, Dave Matthews and Friends. They've got a lot of options.
Dave Matthews and Friends should be, like, a cartoon that Dave writes...
That's a brilliant idea. Today we're going to hang out with Trey Anastasio.
Hey, kids. Ever try Sunshine Acid? It's really great.
You do a good Trey. I like your Trey impression.
It's great. All of my songs are about really weird things. Give you nightmares.
That's why he sings with his mouth open, to let the bad souls out.
Yeah, that's why he doesn't shave, to keep the bad souls out. Wait.
Well, also because he has Indiana Jones melty face. So he hides it up with the folky beard.
Is he a ginger? Is he full on ginger? Right, Trey Anastasio? Is he on ginger level? Is he ginger level ultimate?
Wow, dude! I don't know. He's rich, man. He's probably a daywalker due to assistance from millions and millions of dollars.
Daywalker.
From those fish cheeseburgers they sell at their concerts.
Fish cheeseburger. Crazy. All right, Doug. So you're on the clock for the last thing.
Oh yeah, that's right. So yeah, this week in 2002. The funeral took place of Jam Master Jason Mizell, not to be confused with DJ Jazzy Jeff from Fresh Prince. Anyway, Jam Master Jay from Run DMC, who was murdered by an assassin single bullet on October 30th, 2002. A $30,000 reward was offered in connection with the murder, but to this day, no one's ever been convicted of the killing.
Who would want to kill Jam Master Jay?
Some dick.
Not me. He was a good guy.
Probably Kid Rock.
Do you think they would have caught him if they upped that $30,000 reward to, like, closer to half a mil?
No.
I don't think so either.
I don't think anyone wants to be a snitch.
I think snitches get stitches.
Exactly. And get buried in ditches.
All right. Where'd it happen? Did it happen in New York?
I think so.
Yeah, dude.
They're from right here in Queens. Represent. What's up?
This week's Sucky Song of the Day was brought to you by, Doug, who really doesn't like this band. Doug, what's the sucky song of the day today?
Thank you, Neil. So yeah, it was kind of hard to pick which of their sucky songs I should pick for today. I went with Ace of Base's All That She Wants. Everything this band puts out is horrible.
It's another baby.
This song in particular.
What about The Sign?
Yeah, The Sign's bad. The Sign's bad. And there's that third one.
Don't Turn Around? Is that what you're thinking of?
Maybe. Yeah, I think so.
How does that go, Steve? Don't Turn Around? What is
Don't
it?
Turn Around, because you're going to see my heartbreak.
Yeah. Oh. Aren't these guys just like Chumbawamba 1.0, if we actually think about it?
Chumbawamba 1.0 for chicks. I'll say that.
But The Sign had a good message.
What was it?
It was dance music, man. It was just like crappy dance music from the 90s, right?
Early but 90s I want to know dance. From you what you think the message is.
I saw The Sign. It opened up my eyes. I saw The Sign. I have no idea actually what that song's about. I just know it's in the movie Slackers. And they do like a rendition of it. It's really cool there. I was going to defend Ace of Base, and now I just don't know why I was going to defend Ace of Base. Like, they're like terrible. I think you're right, Doug.
Well, think about the words to All That She Wants. It's like they keep saying over and over again, all that she wants is another baby. She's gone tomorrow, boy. It's about a girl who has a one-night stand just to get pregnant. Is that what the song's really about?
Right.
Unless she didn't go one and done. I mean, it's hard to go one and done. I think maybe she just plays her cards, and then the second she gets knocked up, she's out. Who does that? No one does that.
This doesn't have to do with her getting knocked up. Like, the other baby... Like, this isn't, like... I didn't ever thought this song was about somebody trying to get welfare checks. It's just about, like
she wants a fucking baby.
She wants another man, right? No, she doesn't. She wants another baby?
It says it right here in black and white. If you're in sight and the day is right, she's the hunter, you're the fox. The gentle voice that talks to you won't talk forever. It's a night for passion, but the morning means goodbye. Beware of what's flashing in her eyes. She's going to get you.
God.
Yeah, she's like singling. She's so pointing you out saying, I want you.
So she's a semen demon. It's basically what this is. She's hunting for the proper semen to spawn
with. The message of the song is you have to be aware of her because she's going to come along and sleep with you. And the second there's any responsibility, she's going to leave. You're absolved of anything. It's just sex for you. And that's it. I don't see the problem. Why is that a song?
But see, this idea, it's masked behind this annoying 90s pop. Everyone loves to sing along. Half the time, they don't even know what they're singing about.
You're right. I was thinking of... I can't remember the song now. There was a lot of good dance songs from the 90s. And I think
if by good, you mean crap.
Dude, Groove Is in the Heart.
That song's amazing. Don't even go there.
No, I love it. I'm saying.
That does not fall into the sucky song category.
Groove Is in the Heart.
But I'm thinking of what song? I'm thinking of all those other songs that were like just one-hit wonders in the 90s that were dance tunes. Ace of Base tried to be like a serious... thing, and they're from Sweden, which is where ABBA's from.
They were almost like a legit Milli Vanilli. If Milli Vanilli didn't get caught lip syncing, they probably would have gone down in history like right next to Ace of Base.
I just have to look up Ace of Base songs real quick because I'm missing one song that I
don't do it. No. If anything, you should not look up Ace of Base. You should change Ace of Base searches on your computer to go to puppies.com. You'll have a way better time there.
Oh, dude, what about, it's A Beautiful Life. Oh, that song is terrible. 95, that song is horrible. Oh my God, they sing Cruel Summer. Never mind, these guys suck ass.
Who didn't sing that? Wasn't that like Bananarama also?
Really? So they covered a shitty song because they're a shitty band? All That She Wants, The Sign, Beautiful Life, Don't Turn Around. Life Is a Flower. Yeah, that's a good name for a song.
Life is not a flower. It's not a flower. Life is a crushing meteor from the heavens. And maybe, you know, you could hook up with a few chicks and have some fun. And listen to good music.
I don't know. There's a lot of pop acts that, like, secretly aren't very good. Like Sheryl Crow. Sheryl Crow secretly sucks ass.
Don't say a bad word about Sheryl Crow.
I don't mind Sheryl Crow.
It's a beautiful woman inside and out.
She married Lance Armstrong. She married a dude with one testicle. Like, what kind of fucking decision?
All right, maybe. Who hasn't made some bad decisions?
Dude, you can't judge someone's personal life and their music. Otherwise, you wouldn't like Kanye. And Kanye's awesome. His music is awesome. He sucks.
So that's our show, guys. I just want to thank Doug for all his awesome input and for joining us here today. We hope it's not the last. We know it's the first, but we hope it's not the last time you decide to join us, Doug. And do you have any last words? Anything you want to tell the five or six people who are going to be listening to this and get to this point on the podcast?
Yeah, guys,
you want to shed any
shout-outs? Thank you so much. It was a real honor, and hope I didn't ruin it.
You can't ruin what's already been ruined. So, Steve, any last words? Any final thoughts?
Not this week.
Thanks, Steve. You always give me plenty of things to cut out of the podcast. So remember to subscribe, share, and like us on Facebook. If you don't have a Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter. If you don't have a Twitter, you can get us on iTunes. If you don't have iTunes, you can look us up on FacebookDemoPodcast.com. And if you don't listen to this podcast, then fuck off. I don't need you anyways.
Oh, actually, I meant to mention that. I checked out the website and Twitter and Facebook and everything. You guys work hard, put content out there.
Yeah, we try. It's that's it for our podcast, guys. Follow us and stay tuned. We'll have more coming for you soon. As long as my eyes are still working and my hands are still working and Steve's ears are still working, we'll be coming up with more podcasts.
Good times.
All right, guys, take it easy.
Late.
Later.
Peace.